woman dissolved the arsenic into the glass and cheerily handed it to the next man who passed by. She told him it was sugar water, and he downed it. Several minutes later, she swore she hadn't given a drink to anyone, much less a poisoned one. Another woman grabbed a handgun and shot an intern at the hospital she was staying at. She explained that the intern had treated her badly and refused to relinquish the gun, saying she would kill anyone who tried to take it. Well, there was no arsenic, and the handgun happened to be a ruler, which the woman gripped and refused to surrender. Yet both women believed they were holding something deadly, and both believed they were carrying out a murder under orders. Minutes later, they remembered nothing. These are only two of the dozens of experiments carried out in 19th century France in their quest to understand hypnotism. The underlying question was this: could someone be hypnotized to commit murder? And if so, who should be held responsible? These questions had been posed since Franz Mesmer introduced mesmerism in the 1770s, but now, in 1890, these questions would be subjected to the French legal system after a murder the previous year, in which a woman by the name of Gabrielle Bompard claimed to have been hypnotized and forced to commit murder by her abusive lover, Michel Ayrault. This is part two of our investigation into the Bloody Trunk case. Be sure to hear episode 42 before listening to this one. This is Old Blood, the historical true crime podcast. I'm your host, Elise. Hypnotism is also known as mesmerism because it originated in 1770 when Dr. Franz Anton Mesmer began investigating what he called animal magnetism. He believed there was this mysterious invisible force that impels human beings and could be harnessed for healing. Mesmer believed that he could use magnets to heal subjects. He would begin by bloodletting the patient and then running magnets over the wound to stop it from bleeding. Dr. Mesmer eventually came to believe that mesmerism could cure everything from blindness to epilepsy, but by this point others were also investigating the phenomenon and began attacking Mesmer's claims, even while being forced to admit that sometimes mesmerism actually did help patients. By the 1880s, hypnotism had become wildly popular and wildly divisive. In Paris, socialites hosted hypnotism salons, according to Stephen Levingston, author of Little Devil in the City of Light, which is about this case and my primary source, seeing as I do not speak French. Others of the time enjoyed traveling hypnosis shows. The topic was trending in literature of the time, and scholarship was also at a peak. Levingston notes that in France, which led the publishing world at the time, between 1885 and 1889, produced 37% of the 408 articles and books on hypnosis. In August 1889, a four-day conference regarding the subject was held at the Hotel Dien. This was to be the opening scene for the battle between two schools of thought regarding hypnosis, the climax of which would take place in Gabrielle and Michelle's murder trial. The main question posed was this: is a hypnotized subject responsible for their actions? On the one hand, there were experts who argued that a hypnotized person lost all of their reasoning and faculties and was merely a puppet for the hypnotist. The law professor Jules Ligeois from the University of Nancy led the school of thought, arguing that the subject, quote, lost her faculties of reason, judgment, morality, and will, end quote. Ligeois came to this theory after a series of experiments in which people were hypnotized and ordered to kill. They were told that sugar water was arsenic and a ruler was a gun. And when prompted, the subjects did indeed carry out their orders, regardless of how much it went against their character and morals. Livingston wrote, "The hypnotic subject in Ligeois' scenario is no more culpable than a pistol or knife. The responsible party is the hypnotist." Thus, according to the Nancy School, morality must be changeable. It flies right out the window when a patient is hypnotized and the subject committed the crime without any consciousness of doing so. Ligeois wrote, "All conscience has disappeared in a hypnotized subject who has been forced to commit a criminal act." And if the crime was done without consciousness, it was done without responsibility. And at this point, people began to panic. With traveling hypnotists and salons being held, people all over were being put into a trance, relinquishing power over their own minds and bodies. By this logic, anyone could be turned into a mindless puppet or an unwilling killer. Doctors at the school in Paris disagreed and ranted against the Nancy School for creating hysteria. "You cannot look at someone too rigidly across the table or on a train for fear of letting yourself be hypnotized," said one professor. It was Georges Gil de la Tourette, a young medical student studying mesmerism, who would one day discover the disorder known as Tourette's, named for him. Tourette studied under Dr. Jean-Martin Charcot at the Paris School, La Salpêtrière. Charcot led the Paris School of Thought in their efforts to bring hypnotism back down to earth. Charcot, who essentially founded the field, was the world's leading neurologist. Charcot discovered Lou Gehrig's disease, or ALS, before it was even known as such some 70 years later. He found the connection between syphilis and damage to the nerves and spinal cord. He also basically discovered multiple sclerosis and argued that it was different from Parkinson's disease. Charcot knew his stuff, perhaps a bit more than Ligeois, who was, after all, trained as a lawyer. Charcot began to use hypnosis to investigate the nervous system and found that it helped his patients, particularly those who suffered from hysteria. Hypnosis then became Charcot's career, his obsession. Unlike Ligeois and the Nancy School, Charcot argued that morality is fixed. Your morality does not just go flying out the window when you're hypnotized. It stays with you and prevents you from committing acts that you wouldn't while in a conscious state. Charcot wanted to bring the field of hypnosis back down to earth from the wild animal magnetism claims that it originated with, and that Ligeois had blown out of proportion. Thus, the four-day hypnosis conference was rife with drama. Ironically, Tourette had a problem keeping his mouth shut and had an outburst in which he essentially told Ligeois to shut up and go home because he was only a lawyer. And then he insisted, as he had before, that Ligeois present, quote, "a single case of crime by suggestion," end quote. In other words, a single instance where someone committed a murder by hypnosis. The very next day, Toussaint-Augustin Gouffet's corpse was found rotting in the village of Millery near Lyon. About a year before Gabrielle ran away from her family to Paris, she was visited by the family doctor Sacrest, who was tending to a sick housekeeper. When the subject of hypnosis arose at the dinner table, Gabrielle's dad asked the doctor to try it out on one of his children. Dr. Sacrest first attempted to place her little brother into a trance, and he just giggled. But Gabrielle was another story. The doctor noticed her instantly fall into a deep trance. He gave her a glass of water and told her it was champagne, and after only a few sips, Gabrielle was behaving as though she were drunk. When the doctor attended to Gabrielle on a later occasion, he put her into a trance before removing a wart, telling her that she wouldn't feel a thing. And she didn't. It was impossible to believe she was simulating, Sacrest said. Professor Donato, one of those traveling showmen, visited Lille once to put on a show that Gabrielle attended and volunteered to go on stage. Levingston writes that she also had a boyfriend there who used to practice hypnosis on her. The more Gabrielle was hypnotized, the longer she was able to stay in a trance and the easier it was for her to go into one. By the time she had met Michel Arrode, Gabrielle had already proved herself very susceptible to hypnosis. And according to the doctors, Gabrielle had the right disposition and temperament for it. Ever since Mesmer, doctors had noticed how hypnosis seemed to help certain patients, particularly those with hysteria. We've talked about hysteria several times in this podcast already, but for the new folks, hysteria comes from the Greek word for uterus and essentially means female mania, or the surplus of emotions that make women go mad and ill. Over time, any woman who was not adhering to social norms could be diagnosed with hysteria, as it became this catch-all term to describe an insane woman. Though some doctors did argue that certain men could also suffer from hysteria. Hypnotists discovered that hysterics were able to enter a trance more easily and deeply than others, leading many to believe there was a connection between the two. So, when Gabrielle's lawyers first floated the idea that she had been hypnotized when helping Michelle kill Gouffet, they realized the importance of discussing her mental health and the effect that Michelle's abuse might have had on her mental state during the crime. Like with Alice Mitchell's trial, the doctors dug into Gabrielle's family history to see if they could explain how a girl like her wound up committing such an atrocious crime. Apparently, two uncles of Gabrielle's had gone mad, and as a baby, Gabrielle herself suffered from convulsions. But did this mean she had a hereditary disposition towards crime? Doctors mentioned that she had begun menstruating at the young age of 8, as though it were a sign she inherited madness. The criminologist Cesare Lombroso wrote of females going through puberty at a young age and argued it was a sign of degeneration and made the woman more likely to become a prostitute. We may laugh now, but plenty of people took this quite seriously then. Gabrielle's erratic behavior also contributed to their concerns of madness. While on the one hand papers loved to describe Gabrielle's lack of apathy, how she rarely showed remorse despite being an intelligent woman, she was also described as manic at times with her outbursts of indignation. Inspectors Goron and Jaume agreed and were overall annoyed by all this talk of hypnotism. Against all odds, they had captured the criminals who murdered the bailiff Gouffet and then led them into a manhunt that spread to 3 continents in 1 year. Gabrielle was not hypnotized or a hysteric, they argued. She was just a criminal. Inspector Jaume wrote to himself, "These stories of hypnotism get on my nerves. They take on a greater importance day by day." And he was right. What should have been a murder trial ultimately became the second act for the Nancy Paris battle over hypnotism. Professor Lejoie himself would travel to Paris for the trial and argue on behalf of the defense that Gabrielle was a mere puppet for Michelle, the real killer. Experts who agreed with Charcot and Tourette rallied behind the state's argument that Gabrielle was responsible for her actions and was thus a murderer. "There is hypnotism in the air," Jean joked. "Only it is Gabrielle who magnetizes public opinion." Gabrielle was visited by the psychologist Edgar Barillon, who found her to be a perfect example of hysteria. Her alternating bouts of laughter and tears, her weak will, her need for attention, and her propensity for telling lies, all were classic symptoms of hysteria. And as the medical field then knew, hysterics made prime hypnotism subjects. Barillon concluded that not only was Gabrielle a hysteric, she was a victim of domestic abuse, although he wouldn't have used those terms then. Gabrielle acted as she did as a response to Michelle's cruel behavior. Barillon blamed Michelle for the murder and for Gabrielle's actions. Gabrielle would not have assisted in murder if she were not terrorized by Michelle into obedience. To Barillon, Gabrielle was basically just an abused puppy following orders, saying, quote, "She could have been to a certain degree terrorized by her lover and obeyed him without knowing much about what she was doing." Indeed, Gabrielle and her lawyers explained how clueless she was throughout the entire ordeal. She listened to orders without questioning why. She later claimed that she thought the trunk they traveled to London to get was just for storing clothes. And then there was the time she claimed she stitched the adult man-sized burlap sack without once wondering what it was for. When asked what she thought Michelle was going to do with the bailiff Gouffet, she explained that she was under the impression that Michelle simply wanted to coerce him into signing some banknotes. She had no idea Michelle was going to murder Gouffet. In fact, Gabrielle had no idea what was going on at all. And for Lajoie and the Nancy School, the reason for this was obvious. If Michelle hypnotized Gabrielle and ordered her to forget everything that he had done upon waking, then she would wake and not remember anything. Gabrielle's narrative of the murder, though it had changed since she first arrived back in Paris, was that Michelle forced her to set up for the murder, and when the time came, she handed Michelle the rope and went to put the silk cord around Gouffet's neck, but then froze and couldn't continue with the murder. It was Michelle that jumped out and began strangling Gouffet with his bare hands. "I didn't do anything," she maintained. "I was forced to do ill. I am more a victim than I am guilty." Michelle's tactic was to blame all on Gabrielle. His narrative of the story was that she, the evil succubus, had bewitched him and forced him to commit crimes on her behalf. He had fallen so madly in love with her that he would do anything for her. It was he who was clay in her hands. And when the two murdered Gouffet, it was Gabrielle who placed the noose around his neck. There was evidence this was not true. The medical examiner noted Gouffet was strangled by hand because the larynx was crushed from the force of fingers. But Michelle did not give a fuck. He was pissed that Gabrielle had the nerve to leave him for another man, and he was intent on seeing her get the death sentence, even if it meant that he would too. Possibly he thought he was beyond saving at this point, and just wanted to drag Gabrielle with him to the guillotine. And so, when the trial began in November of 1890, it was an absolute circus, with the Paris and Nancy schools at each other's throats, and Michelle and Gabrielle doing their best to get the other condemned. Before we begin with the trial, it's important that I first remind you how different the courts were in France versus here in the US. Things were much less structured. There were no objections every 10 seconds, and false statements were not challenged or corrected for the most part. From an American point of view, the Court of Assizes, France's criminal court, was more of a free-for-all showdown where most everything goes. And if a witness happened to break down on the stand and do something insane, well, it was all a part of the legal process, all a part of the witness revealing the truth. It was not uncommon for screaming matches and soap opera-style scenarios to be enacted during a trial, like the one Gabrielle and Michelle faced. And the couple had the perfect personalities for such a performance, because it was a performance. As Chief Garon argued, she detested him, he hated her. It was necessary to put the two lovers face to face. That was the only way to discover the truth amid their lies. One of the first acts of this drama began on July 8th, when Gabrielle and Michelle were taken from their cells and transported to the scene of the crime at 3 Rue Tronson du Coudray. Authorities had the apartment recreated as it was on the night of Giuffé's murder. The idea being that the two would get there and begin quarreling over what had actually happened, and in the process let an admission slip or say something damning. Parisians heard of the recreation before the couple arrived on scene and flooded the street trying to get a look at the infamous criminals on their way into the murder apartment. Michelle arrived first, then Gabrielle, who took one look at him and thrust her head to the side, remarking, "I can't see this man. He disgusts me." The main question the court was trying to answer was which one of them placed the silk cord around Giuffé's neck. By this point in time, Gabrielle was claiming it was Michelle who took the sash from her hands and put it around Giuffé's neck. But it did not work, so Michelle gave it up and began using his hands. Michelle maintained that it was Gabrielle who did so. "I did not strangle Giuffé," Michelle said. "I hanged him, or better, we hanged him, Gabrielle and I." The judge stopped to ask him how they found finger marks on Giuffé's larynx, and, without offering another scenario, denied it, saying, "I assure you I hanged him and did not strangle him. The pressure of the cordeliere was sufficient for that." Gabrielle, standing to the side, could no longer take Michelle's accusations and stomped her foot. "You lie, monsieur!" "I tell the truth, mademoiselle," Michelle retorted, "and I advise you to do the same." After order was restored, the two took their places, Michelle behind the curtain with the pulley and Gabrielle by the lounge chair, explaining the narrative of events. She said that Giuffé was so preoccupied with undressing Gabrielle and making out with her bosom that he did not initially notice when Michelle burst from the curtain, grabbed the cord from her hands, flung it around Giuffé's neck, and then threw himself onto the rope behind the alcove. As Michelle pulled down on the rope, Giuffé was lifted into the air, but the weight was too much and the pulley fell from the ceiling, and both men fell. Then, Gabrielle continued, "I rode strangled him with his hands." "Mademoiselle lies," he interjected. "It is she who put the cordeliere around Giuffé's neck, saying to him, 'This would make you a beautiful necktie.'" Gabrielle, nicknamed the little demon by the press, then lunged at Michelle but was restrained by two guards. Michelle was determined to see Gabrielle lose her head with him and insisted the crucial act had been committed by her. Because placing the sash around Giuffé's neck proved intent to kill, Michelle knew the importance of claiming it was Gabrielle who did so. The con man continued his narrative of events, saying when he came out of the alcove, he found Gouffet inanimate. He suddenly became weepy for all the court to see. "I came out of hiding, crying. He's taken! Gabrielle hanged him." Michelle shot a look of pure hatred towards Gabrielle and spat. You could see that a last hope made the wretch's heart beat. Gabrielle lost it and flew at Michelle, trying to shake the guards off her. "Liar! Liar!" she screamed. "Coward! Coward!" She looked like a woman possessed. Goron recalled, she merited well at this moment the nickname of Little Demon that had been given to her. At this point, the authorities realized they were not going to get any more information out of the two, especially with Gabrielle in hysterics, so they called it a day. Gabrielle returned to her cell where she had a panic attack and spent the night sobbing. Gabrielle's savior, Georges Garanger, made an appearance on the second day to describe how she and Michelle had posed as father and daughter in their attempt to swindle and then possibly kill him before Gabrielle intervened. By the time of the trial, Garanger had become distant from Gabrielle, though still intent on sharing her version of the story when the time came. The result was that Garanger was interrupted by both Michelle and Gabrielle when trying to tell jurors what he experienced. The 46-year-old businessman turned adventurer told the court how he had given Michelle 5,000 francs when he still believed him to be Mr. Van Erd, the wine merchant. Michelle denied all this, and the two squabbled over proof of such swindling until Garanger eventually changed course and asked, "Can the witness say how he was able to live in San Francisco without my money?" Michelle ignored the question and tried to change the topic, but the prosecutor demanded he answer. Michelle answered that he had money with him when he got to San Francisco. Gabrielle was sitting with her head down, chewing on her handkerchief, according to Lovingston, when she heard Michelle say he had 300 francs with him upon arrival in San Francisco. Almost as an allergic reaction to his lies, she blurted out, "He had 15 francs in his pocket." Michelle denied this and called Garanger a liar, but Gabrielle would not stop. "We constantly lived on the money from Garanger. He does not want to admit it, but that's the truth." Garanger, too, spat back that everything Michelle said is a fabric of lies. "The slander is on your part. You told the newspapers I wanted to kill you," Michelle said. "I never said anything to the newspapers," Garanger retorted. Michelle was livid, but the judge was hoping for a breakthrough, so he pushed him. "I rode. The truth is that you never forgave Mr. Garanger for taking Gabrielle Bompard from you." But it was Gabrielle who responded. "He did not take me. It is I who left with..." And the uproar in the court was so loud that she was cut off. But Michelle was enjoying Gabrielle's distress, so he turned to ask Garanger, "Would you like to comment on Gabrielle's mental condition?" "My mental condition?" She was outraged. "I took a carriage and I went to the prefecture, and voila!" She waved her arms wildly and stomped her feet until she fell backward, unconscious. Guards rushed towards her, as did spectators, relishing the drama. And then, just as quickly as she had fallen, she was resurrected. "Oh, Michelle! Michelle! Don't kill me! Don't kill me!" Physicians rushed to unlace her clothing and give her ether to calm her down. After a recess, Gabrielle reappeared in court with her doctor at her side, and her lawyer, Henri Robert, center stage. The lawyer directed his questions to Garanger, hoping to connect the day's theatrics. "Didn't you often put Gabrielle Bompard to sleep? Wasn't she a very remarkable subject for hypnotism?" Garanger agreed with Robert, who then asked if he had any experience with hypnotism. "I don't know anything at all," he said. And this was just what the lawyer wished Garanger would say, for the Nancy School had long been saying that certain people were much more susceptible to hypnotism than others, particularly those with neuroses like Gabrielle. If a man like Garanger, with so little knowledge of hypnotism, could put Gabrielle into a trance, then it just went to prove how easily suggestible Gabrielle was. Her mind was extremely easy to influence. It was a nice segue into the third day of trial, which was reserved for, as Levingston says, the princes of science. Well, science-ish, let's just say. The court heard from the forensic expert Dr. Lacassagne, who had performed the second autopsy on Gouffet. He testified that it was most definitely fingers and not a rope or sash that strangled him to death, damning Michelle's version of the murder. Then three doctors who had spent the previous month studying Gabrielle and her mental state were some of the first to testify. The doctors agreed that she did not have hereditary disposition to the crime, however difficult her upbringing may have been, but they did state that she was, quote, incontestably a hysteric. The doctors specified that she was not a grand hysteric, but was simply subject to attacks of nerves. In doing so, the doctors were siding with the prosecution, for if she was a grand hysteric, she would also be prone to grand hypnotism and thus had no control over herself during the crime. Henri Robert, her lawyer, tried to spin things in her favor and began asking questions that suggested Gabrielle had been hypnotized so often it made her a grand hypnotic. The doctors were adamant, though, and made their point clear. "We have seen nothing in Gabrielle Bompard that would make hypnotism accountable for this crime." The star witness of the day was Dr. Jules Ligeois, the professor from the Nancy School, who believed a properly hypnotized subject was one without responsibility. It was Ligeois who had performed all those experiments with the fake arsenic and ruler guns, and came to the conclusion, as he told the court, that it is as if the free will is abolished. He then recounted some of his experiments, just in case the court did not believe him, like one in which he instructed a woman to shoot his friend with a fake gun, and did, and then truly believed the man was dead. As for Gabrielle, Dr. Ligeois stated, "It seems to me it is possible that Gabrielle received some criminal suggestions, and that she realized them in a second state." A second state meaning in a trance. If Gabrielle contradicted herself, it was likely because of a post-hypnotic suggestion that she forget being hypnotized. The doctor was certain of the Nancy School's views on hypnosis and was using the trial to try and win the scientific argument. Gabrielle would become the first example of a person induced to commit murder by hypnotism. And Dr. Ligeois would make sure of it. "I would rather chop off my hands than sign a verdict of condemnation of Gabrielle Bompard," said Ligeois, looking to the little demon who, at the moment, was fast asleep with her head on her doctor's shoulder. Gabrielle's lawyer, Henri Robert, took advantage of the momentum and asked the judge to allow Gabrielle to be hypnotized in front of the court. "Interrogate her on the crime," he said. "I do not fear her revelations." The judge took a few minutes to deliberate on the matter, but then returned to say that he would not allow it. Robert went to Plan B, which was trying to gather sympathy for his client. He went on a diatribe about Gabrielle's neglectful family and described her father as abominable for abandoning his daughter as he had, replacing her mother with his mistress before the coffin had even left the home. Gabrielle was a victim of this world and found herself outside of Michelle's doorstep starving. She gave him a kiss for a morsel of bread, Robert explained. Then she stayed under the influence of misery and violence. Sure, she had been forced to help Michelle set up the apartment and prepare for the crime, but when the time came, Gabrielle could not follow through. She could not place the sash around Gouffet's neck, which was why Michelle had to step in. This was proof of her being hypnotized, he explained. Robert reminded the jury of what the Paris school had to say about hypnotism, and how people do not completely lose their morals when entranced. Charcot, leader of the Paris faction, once argued, "If I ordered one of my subjects to kill, the patient would hit him with an ordinary blow on the back with whatever was on hand, but it would be done without real conviction and in spite of himself. Hypnosis does not change a person's moral resolve. Thus, Gabrielle could not be commanded to place the noose around Gouffet's neck. Instead, she had an attack of nerves, which was exactly what Charcot and the Paris school said would happen when such a situation occurred." Henri Robert knew that public opinion had turned against Gabrielle, the little demon. He knew the evidence against her was overwhelming and that conviction seemed inevitable. But with Gabrielle, he had the possibility of saving her life. Despite earning the nickname Little Demon, Gabrielle was still a woman in a world where men were uncomfortable sending them to the scaffold or guillotine, and Robert was hoping his society's urge to protect women would spare his client. According to the doctors, Gabrielle Bompard is a broken being. If she is a broken person, then she should be sent to a hospital for her mental health, Robert told the jury. Here is the truth, he explained, wrapping up. Gabrielle Bompard is sick. You take care of the sick. You cure them, if you can. You do not send them to prison or the guillotine. Men, you must act in accordance with your heart and your conscience. The other famous lawyer in this trial, Felix Dacoury, and his fabulous mustache, had the task of defending Michelle. Dacoury tried to soften Michelle's image a bit by dabbling in a little bit of his family history and childhood. It is obvious Michelle had made many mistakes throughout his life, but they were just that, Dacoury argued, mistakes. Mistakes made for the sake of love. Sure, he had stolen a horse and deserted the army, but it was only to go be with his lover. He had a violent passion, Dacoury explained. He had an inextinguishable need for that woman, for her caress, for her presence. Before her, he is a child, seduced by her charms, by the softness of her voice. Luck put him in a relationship with a grasping woman lacking in all morality. She would command him, dominate him, and he would obey her. This is what Gabrielle Bompard did to him. The prosecution, representing the murdered Gouffet and his family, had no time for any of that hypnotism bullshit. Both Gabrielle and Michelle were guilty beyond all doubt, and deserved to pay for what they had done. This was an atrocious ambush planned well in advance, the prosecutor told the jury. I ask of you, what becomes of public security if you do not deliver a punishment in proportion to the crime? The issue was more important than they all thought, he argued. If they, as a society, agreed to excuse criminals just because they claimed to have been hypnotized, then all of society was at stake. The prosecutor addressed the jury. If hypnotism explains the crime, if it is a way to deny free will, then we must recognize there is no such thing as human freedom. There will be no conscious choice between good and evil. No criminal will be accountable for the blood he spills, and the book of eternal justice will be closed. It was a gloomy prognosis, and one the jury surely wished to avoid. The jury was out for 2 hours, and when they returned, they found Michelle Arode guilty on all accounts. As for Gabrielle, she too was found guilty on all accounts, but with mitigating circumstances. The little demon was sentenced to 20 years hard labor, and Michelle would be sent to his death. Both were silent upon hearing the verdict, and denied the judge's offer to speak, but Michelle did later comment to a guard, "I was waiting for that." By the time Michelle was being transported back to his cell, his death sentence still hadn't sunk in, and he ranted and raved about how stupid everyone was. "Do you think these people imagine I put Gabrielle Bompard to sleep? If I had that power, I'd put you to sleep right now and break out." He raged that Gabrielle had done just as much as he, and that these jurors didn't understand anything about this case. Felix DeCorey, his lawyer, was in the process of appealing his sentence, and though he had gotten as far as getting each of the 12 jurors to sign a request for clemency, the Court of Appeals rejected it. Michelle and Felix DeCorey hoped the president would intervene and grant him clemency, but the days wore on until his day of execution. There would be no pardon. Michelle would have his head lopped off that very day. Michelle was led to La Roquette prison, and Paris prepared for the day. The guillotine was delivered at 4:30 in the morning, and Parisians were already drinking toasts to the condemned, singing, in French, "It's Arode we must have, it's his head we must have." Vendors filled the streets, hawking miniature metal trunks with teeny tiny corpses inside them, all labeled the Gouffet Affair. Meanwhile, they were preparing Michelle for the guillotine, getting him dressed as he ranted and raved about everything, claiming that the Minister of the Interior was to sleep with Gabrielle that night, and complaining that the executioner was pinching his fingers. They offered him some cognac, but Michelle rejected it, saying, "I told you no," and then, according to Livingston, growled at the priest trying to pray for him. Tradition held that the priest kissed the condemned before their execution, but Michelle wasn't having that either and turned his head away when he leaned in for a kiss. The prison opened in 1830 on the site of a 1690 convent, and it lasted all the way until 1974 when it was demolished and a park built in its place. But you can still see 5 stone slabs set into the street there, which held the feet of the guillotine that executed nearly 70 people. Michelle stayed at the men's prison there the night before his execution, and then was led to the square. And upon seeing the guillotine, Michelle lost it and began jerking his body to shake the guards off and break loose, shouting conspiracy theories about the Minister of the Interior at the crowd. Detective Jaume, who was watching, later commented, "What a singular way to express your last thoughts. Up to the threshold of death, Arode remained an incompetent being, his head full of gaps." Officials dragged Michelle, kicking and screaming, up to the scaffold, and threw him down on the guillotine, locking his head inside. Michel opened his mouth to rave about the minister once more, but was cut off by the blade that fell and separated his head from his body. The head of Michel Hérold rolled forward and into a tin can lined with straw. The bloodthirsty mob rushed forward, eager to see, to touch, to witness, but was shoved back by soldiers mounted on horseback. Eventually, Michel's body was taken down and placed in a coffin with his head between his feet and taken to the cemetery. Gabrielle, meanwhile, continued to be a celebrity in jail, as her lawyer Henri Robert worked for her release. She did not serve 20 years hard labor, as she was sentenced to, and instead found herself in a woman's prison for only 12 of those years, thanks to Robert. By the time she was released in 1903, she was 35. She tried to rejoin society, but she was mostly a black sheep by this point. Still, she was able to travel and visit the famed Dr. Lejoie, whose testimony did much to help her earn extenuating circumstances in the trial. And now, finally, he was able to conduct his test on her and put her into a trance. And despite her many years in prison, Gabrielle quickly fell into a trance and was able to reenact the murder, miming the crime and screeching, "He's strangling me!" She played out the entire murder, just as she had explained during the trial, even failing to loop the noose around Gouffet's neck. She then went into hysterics, screaming, "Murderer!" several times. Dr. Lejoie instructed Gabrielle to tell him what Michel ordered her to do. As a response, she approached the doctor and laced her fingers around his neck. Her story remained consistent, but by this point it was a bizarre spectacle that made everybody cringe. Everyone was over Gabrielle Bompard. She published a confession and account of her life, to which critics note, "She is a star upon which the Barnums would count to make themselves rich." Quite a prediction, seeing as she and Lejoie then tried to begin a traveling hypnosis show. And again, people expressed their disdain for the little demon. As Christians, we must observe the law of forgiveness, but this does not extend to glorifying rogues, one wrote. France may have been sick of Gabrielle Bompard, but that did not make her experience any less symbolic of the Belle Époque. Levingston wrote, "She brought to the forefront French anxieties in the Belle Époque. She symbolized the gaiety and darkness of the era, its freedom and recklessness, its cleverness and uncertainty. Her decadent life reflected the desires and fears of the French in a changing world on the precipice of the 20th century." Gabrielle Bompard died on December 9, 1920. Newspapers called it an unnoticed departure. This is the end of our two-part episode on the Bloody Trunk. We will be back in 3 weeks with our next episode, so keep an eye out. For a list of our sources, see the show notes, or visit our website at oldbloodpodcast.com. Plenty of photos and artifacts connected to the case will be posted on social media, so be sure to search for us on Instagram by typing in Old Blood Podcast. Music credits to Facilian Studios.